changing in the program. The last speaker is Dr. Blake, talking about understanding low energy nuclear reaction by using quantum string theory.
I'm sorry, I'm not a doctor. Doesn't mean that all of this is false. Okay, let's see if this works. So quantum spring theory is a rather elaborate title for a series of models that I'll give you some idea of where all this comes from if I have time. Putting the fizz back into physics. Not just the bounce and the bubbles, but also the physical. So I've heard calls in this conference for a paradigm shift, and also calls for models of the nucleus. And in this little talk, I'll present the paradigm shift and models of the nucleus. How convincing this is what remains to be seen. What is the common thread to all successful Lenard trials? Fusion. Right. And what's common to all fusion events? The binding energy, or mass defect, right? Okay, so what do we know about binding energy? This is old data. The binding energy per nucleon, so you start over here, I don't know if we have a pointer, I guess not, but you start over on the left-hand, your left-hand side with deuterium, and go up to tritium, and then the peak there is helium-4. And then what you're measuring here is how much binding energy there is per nucleon as you add the additional nucleons to the nucleus. And this has been a very mysterious curve. It's the best data we've got on the nucleus. It's well measured. There are databases on this stuff. It's non-monotonic, as you see. You might have expected this to just keep rising. Those guys, you're all in the field. You know how this works, right? But there hasn't been a good model for this yet. But this is at the absolute heart of Lenard. If we don't understand how fusion works, how are we going to, you know, have a model, a theory of fusion that's going to guide our experiments? Well, let's take a look at some of the models that have been proposed. Most of you will be familiar with this, so bear with me. The liquid drop model was the first one that came along. The nucleus is a drop of liquid. You're adding, each time you add a nucleon, you add another drop. You get this circle curve that matches the shape very, very well. I think Gamma did this originally quite some time ago. It's been refined over the years. The absolute error isn't very good in here. The correlation is terrific because it matches the curve well. It's not clear that any of us believe that the nucleus is a drop of liquid. Norman Cook gave a great talk. He's very familiar with this work, very much a pioneer of it. It came along about 1985, and is well covered in his book, which I will sell my copy. I've decided it will be more than $700. I love the book. The absolute error here is terrific. Five times almost improvement on the previous, but the correlation kind of drops off because, as you can see, the experimental data deviates from the actual shape of the curve. So this was the next best that we got. Now I have to talk a little bit about the independent particle model, because this is the model that everybody believes actually is the model of the nucleus. It's based on the idea that the nucleus has quanta, like the electrons have quanta, and therefore these peaks that you saw in the binding energy curve are when the quanta get filled. And that's kind of the model. But you say, where I come from, that dog don't hunt, because there's no room in the nucleons for things to orbit around. Not as we understand the size of nucleons and the nucleus. There's no room in the nucleus for things to orbit. But the main problem with this is it just can't say anything quantitative about the binding energy. And so it's hard for this model to guide us as practical experimental physicists, because it can't tell us anything about that binding energy curve, except that qualitatively it has peaks. This is our data. Now, when I first came up with this, I thought, well, that's nice. The absolute error is pretty good. The correlation's pretty darn good. And how do we arrive at this? Well, this came from somewhere completely out of left field. I started working on a problem. I've got a little bit of extra time, maybe. Do I really have the 20 minutes, or do I only have the 15 minutes? It doesn't matter. I'll tell you very briefly how this all started. Back in the 70s, my daughter was 5 years old. We were having this conversation about all this pavement that are the roads, right? And she said, well, this is stupid. They should be parks. We should be able to walk along the roads. Instead, we have all these cars. And she said, we should float around in the sky in air chairs. And she said, and I said, well, we don't understand what causes gravity. So we can't do that yet. And she said, well, you work on that. And I said, you know, he's indulge your five-year-old daughter, right? Sure. So I started to think about it. And I thought about it in my spare time for about 20 years. And I had an idea. And the idea goes, well, first let's talk about what is the result of what I found. What I claim is that if we went back 100 years to when quantum mechanics was first thrown out, and by the way, there was a lot of debate about quantum mechanics in the early years about how to interpret it, right? And what it really means. We've forgotten a lot about those debates, I think. But if we knew what we know now about particles, about all that we've learned about particle physics and the accelerators and so on, I think we would draw different conclusions about what's going on in the subatomic world. And I actually think, and I've heard this mentioned at this conference already, that the classical laws of physics do apply subatomically. But space has unique characteristics. So let me tell you where this all comes from. And I know that this is going to all seem very odd, but bear with me because we get great results. Suppose you have a box of space, okay? V of SB, volume of space in the box. I'm a physicist, right? And we put a particle in the box. And the question I want to ask you is, how much space is still in the box? Is it the original amount of space less the volume of the particle? Or is it the original amount of space still in the box? And quantum spring theory says it's the bottom one. So what we think is, matter does not replace empty space when particles are created. It displaces the space. Space is compressed like a spherical quantized spring, and it takes force to set a spring, which is all the energy you put in to create the particle, or the photon. So it runs right down through the energy spectrum, and the spring pushes back. And we've heard about the stiffness of space being mentioned, and space is kind of stiff, but it's not stiff enough for a proton to stay, to keep the bubble open without help from the quarks. So protons have content, photons don't. We can't talk about all of this stuff. Is there any evidence for this mad idea? I think there's a lot of evidence. The hydrogen nucleus is larger than the proton. But there's only one thing inside the 1H nucleus, and that's the proton. So this is measured with electron scattering, right? You throw electrons at the nucleus, and you find out by how they bounce off how big it is. And you get a picture like this. This comes from hyperphysics. And you can go to nuclear size and hyperphysics, and you get this picture. And notice how the actual measurement, there's two things about it I want you to notice. One, it's well larger than the proton, okay? And two, it's kind of a soft edge. It's not a sharp edge, okay? So here's our picture. And this is gonna be a bit of a leap for us, I think. So we've got our proton. It creates a bubble in space when it's formed, pushes space out. Space is compressed into this sphere around it. So the proton force on space that's created by the energy that you put in to create proton. We get the nuclear skin on the outside. By the way, the nuclear skin is mentioned a lot in Norman Cook's book, and it's present on all nuclei. There isn't a great explanation for this, by the way. It's always there, and it's always about this size. And then we've got the strong force pushing back. So it's the energy you put into create the particle that pushes space out, and you get the spring effect of space coming back down on the particle, and you get this quark structure, which I've happened to arrived at a buckyball for this structure, but it could be some other structure, or no structure at all, just quarks in there running around, keeping things at bay. I have no idea because I've never seen the inside. I just made a hypothesis. I tried some other shapes, by the way, cubes and tetrahedrons, they didn't work too good. But this works pretty good, because as you see up here in the corner here, on the little red bit where it says binding energy, when that spherical cap is cut off because this particle comes up and nests against another particle, that's the mass defect. That's masses lost. That's your binding energy. And this is how we get that curve. And the thing you notice about this is, in the buckyball, as it turns out, there are two different spherical caps, hexagonal caps and pentagonal caps. The hexagonal caps are a little bit bigger. So we get two quanta, two different sizes of binding energy that we can work with, which gives us three different combinations when we put particles together. Two pentagonal caps, a pentagonal cap, and a hexagonal cap, or two hexagonal caps. Right? Wonderful. Just a little bit more on this. The space around the particle is compressed, and that causes the electrons to scatter like we saw in the previous diagram. And by the way, it just happens to be the radius of that space just happens, as measured, just happens to be the wavelength of the proton. And the wavelength of the proton is, as you can see, speed of light times Planck's constant divided by the energy to create the proton. Which means that the particle and the wave are always there all the time. It's not one or the other, depending on how you observe. So I've heard at this conference, maybe there are parts of quantum mechanics that aren't applicable as much because we've got more experimental evidence now than we used to have. And this is part of that story. So, mass defect. Proton comes together with a neutron. We've got up quarks in blue on the proton, and the down quark in the middle. Pretty fanciful. Actually, the number of segments do relate to the actual masses of these particles as measured as best as they are. Not well measured. Neutron has two down quarks and an up quark in the middle. By the way, it's pinned to the side so it doesn't rattle apart and decompose in 15 minutes, or apparently the new measurement, 10 minutes. And there's our lost spherical caps. And that's the binding energy of deuterium. So, what's important? Classical mechanics applies at subatomic scale, and Lenard's a problem in materials and mechanics, which really puts it on a completely different footing. Now, it doesn't mean that there's any contradiction between this model and other ideas we've heard here today and yesterday. It just means that there are multiple models looking at this problem from different angles, and they all have something to tell us about what's going on here. So, what are the physical conditions we need? A stable target nucleus, an impact nucleus, that's it. So, this whole talk came from David Nagel's paper, which is about to be published, where he challenges us with theories about Lenard to answer, 24 different observations that he's made across a large number of Lenard experiments and 10 different questions that have been asked. So nuclear reactions can be initiated. So I'll just talk quickly about the observations, just a few of them. Nuclear reactions can be initiated with low energy. Some that occur in small and distinct regions near the surface. For electrochemical experiments, high ratios of deuterons to PD atoms favor Lenard. These are just observations that I think we all know from the experiments that have been done. And a few measurements show that Lenard has a very rapid onset, which I think is actually quite important. What can we conclude? What does quantum spring theory say about these questions? It says that these are the conditions that are likely to attain the Fermi velocity, which is the velocity you need to overcome the Coulomb force. So there's one idea. There are at least two other ideas, or three other ideas in this conference. The two we just heard in the two previous talks, and the one from yesterday from Zupero that is yet another idea. It's important for us to understand which one of these is the correct model or which set of them. I don't know, but that's what that I didn't know about those talks when I did the slides, so you get what I knew at the time. Connection to Leonard from our theory? Well, we've got the architecture of fusion nailed. Mechanics work at subatomic scale. I think that puts us on a different footing. The foundations of the concept are that the mass defect is in the spherical cap. It doesn't matter whether it's, what the hell's on the inside, really. It does matter that there are two different kinds of caps, or losses of energy, mass defects. How many steps does it take to do Leonard? Well, load the target, shoot neutrons at it, or hydrogen. Equations written, yes, well, at least for our understanding of how fusion works, that's been published rather a while ago. It took a while for me to understand that was relevant to our topic today. Pretty good accuracy, as I've mentioned. We do explain the 24 observations, but I didn't go over all of them now because there isn't time in the talk. I can't predict how long it takes to load the target or how long fusion will last once the target's loaded because it just depends on too many variables. If you're doing it electrochemically or with gas or some other way, what the material's like, I couldn't answer this one. Do we explain all of Leonard? Well, everything except maybe why we don't get gamma out when we get our helium formed. But I actually have a hypothesis around that now, and I think there were other good explanations in this conference that are probably much better than my conjecture anyway. So maybe we'll team up and form a meta theory that will explain everything. Is the theory testable? We think so. So got to form a little company. I've filed a patent. I'd like to build a prototype. If anybody has any spare change, come talk to me. Yes, I think we can test it. I can't say a lot about that unless you sign the NDA, because my investors, the potential investors, would get unhappy with me. But I do think there's a potential to test all this. So, yeah, that's about it. So, any questions? Do we have time for questions?
Yes, I have 3 minutes, maybe. First question, please.
A number of, I could ask you those questions, but a couple come to mind. Is your buckyball an emergent property? You use that to do that as something that emerges. And can you count the spin, dipole, and gravity?
Okay. The buckyball is formed, if there is such a thing, when the particles form. So I'm not sure if that counts as emergent or not. I don't understand the time scale of that, no concept. Can I talk about spin? No idea at all yet. You guys are going to help me with that. Gravity, absolutely. There is a paper before this paper where I talk about what causes gravity. It kind of needs to be revised based on what I've learned in the last 9 years. So there's definitely stuff on it. Some of that is covered in the poster session to some extent. But it's basically those nuclear quanta, when they come together between two particles, they want to go back to that home position of that where it's it's the radius, the actual home position of the radius, and that's what causes gravitation between all the particles.
One other thing. Obviously, you're thinking that space has inertia problems without
it. That's kind of right.
So you didn't like the liquid drop model, I see.
Well, I didn't think it matched the data very well. That's all I'll say about it.
Okay, so people have been interested in that in recent times. So people start working with the Thomas Fermi model, which is closely related to liquid drop, or the liquid drop can be derived from it. And then people work with kind of density functional closely related to Thomas Fermi, and they corrected it and they generalized it. And they've been fitting it to, getting versions of it that are fit to the known masses. And the general agreement these days is awfully darn good. So there's probably 30 or 40 papers out there with models that compare against the modern masses. I can send some of them to you.
That would be wonderful. I'm out of date there, and I apologize. That's very interesting.
Last question, please.
My
My name is Bogan. I'm an electrical engineer, new to this cold fusion, and I have a crazy question. Many people call me crazy. And I expect when you mention one of the slides, you say layers, first layer. How many layers are there in hydrogen atoms?
Oh, I think those layers, those nuclear quantum layers go right out, just like the electron quantum layers do. Right? They start when the particles form, and I think, conjecture, they go out at the speed of light to, you know, to
unlimited? Unlimited layers?
Unlimited.
Because I expect some definite number of layers.
Well, there's...
It cannot be that open.
My understanding, now I don't know everything by a long shot, but my understanding of electron layers is they're also thought to continue to go out past the last one that's usually occupied. I think that's the general consensus.
Do you advise me? Reading more.
Yeah, unfortunately, this whole idea of having nuclear quantum layers is kind of new. So I you'll have to look at my papers, and then the rest of you guys will have to help me make this theory make sense.
Thank you.